We're honored today to have Mr. Durst come to visit us, and we look forward to this every 2 years to get an update of what's going on at ISBVI. And let me tell you, I've been out there within the past 2 weeks two times, and I was just amazed when I came away from the award ceremony and the graduation. So, Mr. Durst, take it away.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. I am, it's always a special thrill for me to come and talk to you about one of my favorite things, the Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And but I do have to tell you, following Bernie Egan is not something that I anticipate. Bernie, what a great job and what inspiring words, you know. You know, Bernie referred to his wife several times and, you know, how much of a help she is to him. Well, you may or may not know it, but my wife Leslie and I have worked in the blindness field, if you will. This is our 43rd year, and we've always worked together. We've had that privilege and that honor. And in 1991, we moved to Indianapolis, specifically to come to the Indiana School for the Blind. I was out here previously and saw this fabulous school with this fabulous students that were doing such a wonderful job. I said, this is a place I want to be part of. And the principal's job opened up, and I came in after following Mo Harrelson. And, we moved here, like I said, in 1991, came out and wasn't quite sure where to live, and heard about this community north of Indianapolis, and we thought we'd check it out. So we're driving north of Indianapolis, and Leslie said, where are we going? I said, we're going to go look and check this community out that I heard some good things about. It's called Carmel, Indiana. And Leslie said, Jim, I think you're mispronouncing that. It's called Carmel, Indiana. And I said, no, Leslie, I'm really confident it's Carmel. So back and forth we go, Carmel, 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 Carmel. And finally, you know, I said, look, we've got to settle this. I said, I'm going to pull into the next place I see, and we'll get this settled once and for all. So I pull into this establishment, and we walk in, and I said, excuse me, ma'am, if you could please, you know, help us out here. I said, we have a question to ask. And I said, if you could very precisely and slowly tell us where we are, I would greatly appreciate it. And the lady looked at me, and she said, well, okay, sir. You're at Burger King. So needless to say, it is Carmel, Indiana, and we ended up moving to Lawrence. So but you know, the Indiana School for the Blind is steeped in history, steeped in tradition. And, you know, before I tell you a little about what the school is and what we're doing, let me tell you a little bit about the past. And I'm sure you know a lot of this, but you might not know. We got our start early on in 1847. And in 1847, we got our start as a result of an individual who was part of the Presbyterian Church who went to Louisville, Kentucky for a meeting for the Presbyterian Synod. And while he was at that meeting, they brought some students over from the Kentucky school to entertain them. They were really impressed with the students from the Kentucky school. They had to be impressed with them because we didn't have any Indiana students yet. And he came back and he spoke to the legislature and said, you know, I was in Kentucky and they have a school there. And I think Indiana deserves and should have a school also for their students. And the legislature agreed. And the school opened originally in a private residence in downtown Indianapolis. And after the first year, the proprietor doubled the rent. And at that point, the legislature said, you know, we really legitimately need to have a school of our own. And they built the school on the site of the war memorial and opened their doors shortly thereafter that. The first school had 9 students. And they recruited the principal from the Kentucky School for the Blind, William Churchman, a name you have all heard many times, steeped in our history. And William Churchman traveled the far reaches of the state with horse and buggy to recruit students to come to the school. And had a number of students come to the school. School was doing very well, but they never referred to William Churchman as superintendent. And they didn't refer to him as superintendent because up until that point in time, there had never been a superintendent of a school that was blind. And they referred to William Churchman as the principal with authority rather than superintendent. The Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired is the ninth school in the country. Schools started out certainly with Perkins being first, and then moving west as the different states were formed and founded. And the School for the Blind hired their first graduate as a member of the staff in 1856 as a music assistant. And they paid her the incredible sum of $100 a year plus room and board. We moved to our current location on September 30th of 1930, and we are one of the largest schools for the blind in the country now, based on the number of students we serve and based on the number of students that we have enrolled. Our funding is primarily through the state, 97% of our funding, 2% through federal grants, 1% through donations. And we provide the same coursework, as you know, as any other public school in terms of core curriculum. But we also spend a considerable amount of time with the expanded core curriculum, which include all of those very important things like communication modes, orientation mobility, social interaction, assistive technology, self-determination. You know, and it's really interesting. You know, core curriculum is absolutely important, no doubt about it. But I've always made the argument and will continue to do so that the vision-specific skills are vitally important. How important is math if you can't get to math class? You know, so the orientation mobility is just incredibly important. The school, as you know it, we sit on 60 acres. We have 30 buildings. 14 of the buildings were constructed prior to the opening in the 30s. Six were constructed in the 60s, two in the 70s, two in the 80s, and six in the 90s. So in terms of where we are and what we've done recently, we've graduated 27 students over the last 2 years with a diploma or certificate of completion. We graduated 18 students a few weeks ago. I see Denisha's here. Denisha, anybody else here with you? Yeah. Welcome, Denisha. You know, I tell our graduates they're about to enter a group of alumni that are very distinguished, who know places in the school that I have yet to find. And you know, I always try to make a point of trying to keep you older alum away from our current graduates because you know, I don't think they found all of the places that that you managed to find over the years. But we've graduated a significant number of students. We continue to meet our requirements in terms of outcomes and how well students do. We've added significant technology infrastructure over the last several years in the amount of $1 million. We put $1 million into the infrastructure, which also includes cameras. The school is now steep with cameras all over campus, all the hallways. A lot of the outdoor structure is now monitored by cameras. So those of you who used to be there, needless to say, boy, would you get caught doing some stuff you shouldn't do. And I routinely tell our students and our staff, don't pick your nose because we can certainly see you do that. And we've added an awful lot of assistive technology lately also. And, you know, one of the things that that is vitally important and continues to be important and we feel very strongly about is Braille. And one of the requirements that we established about probably 6 or 8 years ago, if not longer, that all of our teachers must be proficient and must show proficiency in Braille. And as a result of that, we require teachers to routinely take a Braille examination. They must pass the Braille examination. If they don't pass it the first time, we give them a second time. If they do not pass the Braille examination the second time, I'm sorry to say they are no longer employed at our school. As a school for the blind, if we don't require Braille, who should? I mean, my goodness, it's so vitally important. Exactly. You know, some other things that we've done recently. We've recently purchased 3 new mini buses with private dollars. We've leveraged our technology to put in a voice over IP phone system and intercom system. We have worked very closely. Are any of you familiar with the MAMP project? MAMP, M-A-M-P?
No.
MAMP is a Miami Accessible Media project that we started, it's probably been 10 years ago now. You know, one of the things we have discovered is Braille is vitally important. Braille is very expensive. Rule of thumb for Braille used to be, under the previous Braille code, English Braille American Edition, rule of thumb used to be it is 3 to 5 pages of Braille for every print page, and Braille ran anywhere from 50 cents a page to $4.50 a page. Well, as you know, and we have recently adopted UEB, Unified English Braille, and UEB, while it's unified, it's actually more voluminous than EAB used to be. And as a result of that, the cost of Braille has gone up considerably. Giving you an example is a few years ago, actually 2 years ago, we needed a new calculus book and we needed a new physics book. The print book of the print books for physics and calculus ran just under $400. How much do you think the Braille book cost? $100,000. $100,000 for one book. But do you know what? We still need to purchase those books because individuals who are blind or have low vision have the same right and responsibility to have access to information at the same time. So one of the things that we've done is we work with MAMP, and MAMP is housed up at the Miami Correctional Facility, and we have hired 40 offenders, and we have trained offenders in Braille. We've trained them to transcribe Braille. We've trained them to do large print, and they've also have developed accessible formats. So with the accessible formats now, we are able to draw down files, and through Braille touches and Braille notes and whatnot, like individuals who have sight can use Kindles and whatnot, and where you used to haul those 80-volume books from class to class. Well, we still have kids that are hauling 80-volume books from class to class, but with the advent of some of this assistive technology, they can now have 20, 30, 40 books on a piece of equipment. And it's really made a difference. You know, so one of the questions we're frequently asked is, will Braille continue and how important is Braille? Well, absolutely, Braille will continue. It's vitally important. And even, you know, people say, well, with all this assistive technology, will Braille continue to be a valuable option? I said, absolutely, because Braille is literacy, and we need to have the Braille for literacy purposes. A couple of other things that we've done is We have, you may or may not know, some of you who are recent grads, you know, we added a head house to the horticulture building. We have just done some fencing around the horticulture building. We have expanded our outreach program by hiring additional teachers. You know, one of the things that we did about 7 or 8 years ago, we decided it was more important to serve students than it was to enroll students. And one of the things that we found was, you know, when I meet with some of my superintendent counterparts, you know, the conversation generally goes something like, "Hey, Jim, how are you? How many kids you got?" And how many kids you got is kind of indicative as to how successful your school is and how important your school is. Well, we have historically, when I moved here in 91, we averaged about 180 to 190 students. Over my tenure there, I think at one point the largest we had was 214. And we decided it was important to serve students because, like many of you, your parents made the decisions from the far reaches of the state to send you to Indianapolis to go to school. Hard, hard decision to make. And so we decided we need to kind of take our show on the road and start serving kids in the districts directly. And as a result of that, now we're serving 360 kids out in the districts where we are the direct service providers. Now, you know, the good news is we're serving 360 kids out in the districts. I guess bad news is, if you will, our enrollment on campus last year was 135. So, but I think it's more important. We're touching 360 kids we wouldn't have touched before. And we're, you know, we're making a difference for those kids and giving them opportunities that they probably wouldn't have had otherwise. Some other things, we're working cooperatively and collaboratively with North Central High School. Some of the other high schools in the state. Some of our students take part of their coursework at local high schools as well as ISBVI. And I don't know if you recently heard the news. We have a student at our school by the name of Noah. And Noah splits his day between Hamilton Southeastern and ISBVI. He qualified for states for Hamilton Southeastern in track. He competed in track at the state meet last weekend. He won first in the 200. He won second in the 100. And his time in the 200 is a new world record for USABA. So pretty phenomenal stuff. You know, and, you know, we can't do the stuff that we do alone. You know, we receive good funding and good support from the legislature. But the reality of it is it's expensive to educate students who are blind or have low vision, regardless of where they go to school. And not being able to do ourselves, we're very fortunate to have some other organizations. The Indiana Blind Children's Foundation, Laura Alvarado's in the back behind us out there. Everybody wave to Laura. Hi, Laura. The IBCF has really made a difference. It's been in existence for a number of years, but it had a new, fresh breath of life breathed into it when Laura took over at the helm. And over the course of the last couple of years, so I think at Christmas time last year, they gave us a check in excess of $100,000. We have another check coming, I think, $20,000, Laura, in next week or something, $20,000 next week. And one of the things that they have recently accomplished is Laura was very instrumental in acquiring a grant in excess of $1 million to renovate the auditorium. And that the auditorium renovation, it includes new lighting. It includes a new sound system. It includes a new projector. And probably the biggest thing is it's going to be a fully accessible auditorium in terms of some wheelchair access, some mobility access. And And the sound system is going to be set up. We are told that it will rival any professional movie house in Indianapolis when it's completed. So one of the things we're excited about doing is we are hoping and planning on showing productions on campus that you as alumni and members of the community can take advantage of on a fairly regular basis. Our Christmas trees are doing well. Dave Schneiders, who former employee, started the Christmas tree farm when he was a teacher as a project to teach kids how to plant trees. And it has evolved to a pretty extensive project. I think this past year we sold $16,000 worth of Christmas trees. And that funding goes to support field trips, our senior prom, and some other activities. We continue to do well in extracurricular activities, wrestling, cheerleading, track, forensics. We have done some downhill skiing. We take some kids now and then out to Vail, Colorado for downhill skiing. And you may have heard this story once before. I've told it several times, but I'll share with those of you who haven't. One of our former students came to me. He was a low vision student. They were about to head off to Colorado. And he said, Mr. Durst, I'm really looking forward to going on this trip, but I don't want to wear the orange vest that says blind skier. He said, you know, I have some sight, and I don't want to wear the vest. And I said, well, David, I said, if you're going on the trip, you have to wear the orange vest. I said, it's a requirement of the slopes. He said, all right, if I have to. We came back from the trip, and he beelines it to my office, and he says, I said, how'd the trip go? He said, oh, Mr. Durst, he said, that trip was great. I said, so how'd that orange vest work out? He said, I got to tell you, he said, that orange vest was okay. He said, every time I got in line to go up on the lift, everybody let me go to the front of the line. I said, that's pretty cool. And he said, and I got to tell you, when I was coming down the hill, there was never anybody in front of me. So there are some advantages with that orange vest. You know, one of the things I routinely say is, you know, I talk about, you know, I'm frequently told how wonderful it must be to work at the School for the Blind. And I will tell you, it is absolutely a wonderful place to work. Wonderful place to be. I came there by choice almost 29 years ago. I don't regret making that move by any stretch of the imagination, because I guess first and foremost, we have students that are students. They're not blind students. They're students who happen to be blind or have low vision. And an example of that is our salutatorian this past year is a low vision student. And several weeks ago, she met me in the hallway and she said, Mr. Durst, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? And I said, sure. She said, well, you know, I have low vision and, you know, I don't see real well, but I have to ask you, do you have really white hair or are you bald? And I said, I have really white hair. So,
was that the truth?
It's the truth. It's the truth. It's the truth. You know, one of the things I want to bring your attention to, I don't know if any of you have heard of House Bill 1443. Hands up if you've heard of it yet. Okay. House Bill 1443 is legislation that was recently passed. And basically, it's legislation that formed a study committee or a task force to look at combining the Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired and the Indiana School for the Deaf. And I will tell you that, you know, over the course of my career, I have been part of or heard of multiple studies where they have attempted to make that decision, and we have been told that this decision is not being based on programming or student outcomes. It is strictly a look at combining physical plants because of the infrastructure of the two schools. You know, our school, as I said before, we moved in September 30th, 1930. We are a rather expensive campus. One of the things that I tell people routinely You know, the wonderful things about the Inez School for the Blind and Visually Impaired is we have this wonderful old architecture. One of the bad things about our school is we have this wonderful old architecture. You know, it's expensive to keep it up. And so the purpose of the task force is to make the determination whether or not it's feasible to, A, move our school to theirs, their school to ours, or develop a new school. So I will keep you apprised of how that study goes. What I will tell you is, if it does happen, if the decision is made, I'm anticipating it'll take 5 to 10 years for anything like that to happen. If it does, and like I said, this is probably the third, fourth, or fifth time that I've been part of those kinds of studies in the past. 20 years ago, I think, was about the last time it went through. And 20 years ago, I think the numbers were, it was $35 million to move us to them, $50 million to move them to us. So, you know, it's a pretty expensive proposition. But I do want to keep you apprised of that, and may call upon you at some point to, you know, get your input and so on and so forth. Because, you know, one of the things that, the thing that makes the Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired isn't our wonderful old architecture. The thing that makes our school is you. Our graduates, our current students. They're buildings. You know, buildings are buildings, but a school is students and student outcomes. And, you know, Bernie made the comment that, you know, each of you have so much to offer and each of you have been successful in your own right. Absolutely so. I mean, you know, we are fortunate to have the reputation. We have a national reputation for excellence. And our national reputation for excellence isn't because we have a tower in front of our building. It's because of the outcomes and the good job that you do as alumni. So I applaud you. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and chat with you. I'm certainly willing and happy to answer any questions you might have about the school and bring you up to date on anything that I may have missed. Questions? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. My name is Frank Ricks. I'm a graduate of 1967. First of all, I'd like to say that it's really great to hear of all the advancements. And I always did love my school, as my school still is. It's our school. But what I would like to know is, all of us, I know I speak for all of us in here, we used to really enjoy having our alumni conventions at the school. And it was done for years and years, even before I graduated. And what I'd like to know is, why is it that we cannot come to our school, our parents, as you said, chose to send us there. Our parents were taxpayers, and now many of us are taxpayers. That school belongs to us as well. We're part of it. We're still part of it. Why can't we still come out there? Why can't we visit? Why can't we have tours? Why can't we have our alumni convention there? Other public schools have alumni come back and visit. Why can't we come back and visit our school? Yes! This is ours. We don't go there anymore. We don't live there, but it's still our school. We don't. Good Elias B. It's our school. Yes!
Frank? You are absolutely right. And what I will tell you is, the school did not make the decision for you to not come to the school for your alumni conventions anymore. I welcome you. I have, one of the things that's happened over the course of time is, I've met with alumni over the years. And for many, many, many years, I was able to underwrite the vast majority of the costs, allowing you guys to come for minimal expense. Well, as costs go up and we're accountable for dollars. Excuse me a second. My phone's ringing. You can't hear it. I need to. As costs go up, I wasn't able to write off all of the costs, but we kept the costs to a minimum. If you want to have your conventions at the School for the Blind next year or the year after, I welcome it. We did not say you couldn't come. That was a decision that was made by your alumni decision makers. And in terms of coming out and visiting the school, I welcome you coming to visit the school. But what I will tell you is, it's a different time. You can't knock on the door and wander the halls like you could have years ago. I can't do that at the school that I went to anymore. Unfortunately, it's become a very dangerous place out there. And we are required to have strong security to ensure the health, safety, and well-being of our students and our staff. I mean, you hear about it every day. There's shooting in schools going on all the time. I don't want the School for the Blind and Visually Impaired in Indiana to make the news as a result of that. So, again, it is your school. It's my school, too. And if you have the impression you're not welcomed at the School for the Blind and Visually Impaired, I don't know why you have that impression, because I welcome you. And if you want to bring your convention back to ISBVI, by all means, let's sit down and talk about how that can happen. Yes. Yes.
My name is Cindy.
Hi, Cindy. You were gone before I got there, thank God.
My question is, cost-wise, I know there's a cost-wise as far as holding convention at the school. Can you give us a guesstimate of what it would cost per person to hold it? I know what we're paying in a hotel.
Yeah, you know, I guess I can't tell you what it'll cost, because a lot of it depends on what you want as a result of the convention. What I will tell you what we did last time, you know, because it's a school and because of liability purposes and so on and so forth, I have to have staff at school while you're there. I mean, I can't just hand you the keys and come back, you know, Sunday night. Lord knows I would never hand you the keys. But because of that, we have to have staff there. And when we sat down with some of the previous groups, you know, we have to have staff in different areas, A, to ensure your health, safety, and well-being, to help you and assist you finding things and this, that, and the other. But we truly did keep the cost somewhat to a minimum. You know, again, willing to sit down with folks and, you know, keep the cost to a minimum. I think it's important for you to be on campus. I was, quite frankly, disappointed the first year I heard that it wasn't on campus.
Hold on, I've got the microphone. I know. Mr. Durst, my question is, I'm a little concerned, and what really bothers me, because I know every public school, every other blind school has a homecoming. And we used to have a homecoming, whether it was a track meet, I think they tried swimming. That didn't work so well, but wrestling was always a big biggie. And I just don't understand why the Indiana School for the Blind no longer has a homecoming.
I guess, you know, what I'm hearing is there's a breakdown in communication between your organization and the school. You know, so I guess what I would encourage you is for you to have some folks meet with us and meet with me and talk about doing some of those things to keep you actively involved at the school as much as we can. You know, I'm certainly not opposed to, you know, homecomings and coming, letting you know when different events are and being part of those events. Not an issue at all to me, other than the fact that I want to keep you away from our graduates so you don't tell them all the hiding places and all the secrets that you know. But short of that, I'm good with it. Jeff Claxton, question.
I hope we do get to come back. I enjoy the school. I have a lot of good memories there. And I understand that you have to the people downtown have you by the you-know-whats. You have to answer to them. I know that's life. But I hope we do get, I hope we do get to come back to the school, and because there's, I, like I say, there's a lot of good memories there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. Sorry, guys. But I would like to know to what degree you encourage your students now, because as I think you've heard Bernie say, a lot of us were discouraged from the path we wanted to take. I know I wanted to go into nursing, and I was told how ridiculous I was to think that a blind person could do that. And also... I had another question, but I can't remember what it was. Yeah, I'd just like to know to what degree the students are encouraged. Oh, also, as Bernie also alluded to, we were all told that if we weren't athletes, we basically, you know, in our time, weren't going to amount to much. And I'm wondering how much that has shifted.
Well, you know, I think it's shifted a lot. You know, I think... schools for the blind in the past, wrestling was really important stuff. Wrestling was important stuff. And the reality of it is, not everybody can be wrestlers. And, you know, so what do we do in terms of encouraging other opportunities? Well, we kind of look at the Indiana School for the Blind and Visually Impaired as our students' home away from home. So we have the responsibility to give them every opportunity that we can, and we're pretty open. I think Denisha, sitting up here as a recent graduate, will tell you, if students come forward with an idea and say, hey, I would like to start a club doing this, we try to find out how to start a club doing that. If they want to do something out of the ordinary, then we do something out of the ordinary, because I think we are limited primarily only by the lack of ideas that we might have in moving forward with some of that stuff. You know, my expectation for kids, and again, I refer to our students as kids, my expectation for our students is that they can do anything they want to do if they want to do it bad enough and they're willing to do it, and they can determine the necessary accommodations that are required to do it. And I think our STEP program, Student Training and Employment Program, that we offer every year, you know, the statistic is still pretty alarming. Greater than 70% of individuals who are blind or have low vision are unemployed or underemployed. And the reason being, we have done a less than adequate job of informing employers of the good work that our students can do. And I think the STEP program is a prime example of that. We get students into the workforce. Employers realize, I didn't have to provide the accommodations that I thought I had to provide. And our students show up for work. They're good workers. So in terms of, we aren't limiting kids at all. I think some of the stuff we've done with some of our collaborations with IUPUI and with some of the high schools, part-time here, part-time there, J. Everett Light. Denisha, were you at JEL? What were you at JEL? What'd you do? Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we have kids at JEL, students at JEL, so we provide a lot of other opportunities. Let me tell you one more thing that we've done that I think is pretty exciting. You may or may not know Jacob Ayers. Jacob is a graduate of the school, graduated several years ago. Jacob was working at a museum while he was going to school up north. And while working in the museum, he met with some of the museum folks and he said, you know what? I can't benefit from this museum because I can't touch stuff and I can't experience it. So you really need to be looking at doing something different. And he said, you know, have you thought about any 3D printing? And they said, well, you know, that's something we've, you know, thought about, but we haven't gotten into it much. Well, Jacob came down to the school shortly after that and he said, you know, Mr. Durst, he said, you know, have you thought much about 3D printing at your school? And I said, you know, I really haven't. It was kind of just starting out. And Jacob explained it to me and everything. And he said, what do you think? I said, I think it's a great idea. Can you start on Monday? And Jacob pretty much started shortly after that. And now we have pretty much one of the state-of-the-art premier 3D print labs at the school. And one of the things recently, we were able to acquire through a donation 200 3D printers from China. And then, you know, the good news is we had 200 3D printers, and it's like, okay, so we have the printers. What are we going to do for product in order to print? Because the plastic spools are pretty expensive. About 3 weeks later, we heard from another company in China, and they donated $150,000 worth of product for us. So we are doing all kinds of stuff with 3D printing in the classrooms and whatnot. And when Jacob started, one of the things that we're in the process of doing now, we're doing a 3D model of the entire school inside and out. So students can experience it tactually, where so-and-so's room is and how to get from point A to point B. And Jacob came to me one day and he said, I'm going to take the drone out and run it around campus a little bit so I can get some images so we can do this 3D scale of the school. I said, great. So probably 3 hours later, he comes to my office. He said, hey, Jim, I don't know if you know it or not, but there's an extension ladder on top of the tower. And I said, we've been looking for that ladder for 5 years.
Nice.
I said, you know, so one of the things we recently did, many of you are probably recent enough graduates that your picture is still on the wall outside of the education office and down the hall and so on and so forth. And I was meeting with Steve Mannheimer several months ago, and we got to talking about the portraits and stuff. And I said, you know, the portraits are really nice. They're nice for individuals who can see them. They're not necessarily nice for the individuals who have low vision or are blind and can't benefit from them. So through our conversations and in conjunction with IUPUI, we did 3D portraits of all of our graduates this year. And I brought some samples of those, and I'll pass them around and let you look at them. Please give them back because they are our graduates, and we have promised to get them to them. But let me pass those out and let you take a look at them.
It was a very nice article.
This is Jeremy Dillahay, class of 96. I have a comment and a question. The comment is I would love to see another convention at the school in 2013. When I found out that we weren't having at the school, I cried. And my question is, Mr. Durst, are these how big are these 3D printers? Because these things sound so awesome. I wanted a 3D printer for a long time.
They come in different sizes. The ones we have are not very large, but again, they're industrial to commercial. I mean, they vary in size. One of the things that we're in the process of.
No, he hasn't yet. Mr. Durst, this is Kevin Mattingly. How are you? He's not listening. This happens to me all the time at work, too. Mr. Durst. My name's Kevin Mattingly. How are you? And, all right, we might expel you from the meeting room at this point in time. I do have a comment about experience versus education. My son went to California Institute of the Arts, and his education was based around application. Now, my son is an IT programmer for Wells Fargo now, but that experience came from hard work afterwards, and people, you don't open doors with education, you open doors with experience. So the one thing that I would like to suggest to you is that you work and partner with businesses, put the kids into projects that apply to business applications and allow them to be able to put on a resume after graduation that not only have they been educated, they have gained experience.
On-the-job
So experiences, education is wonderful, but I never got the door never opened for me because of education. It opens for me because of opportunities based on experience. And I will tell you that if you apply at Wells Fargo and you do not have the minimums, you will not even, the door will not open at all. So when I know you were talking about high school kids, but this is real important for those kids that are vocational kids that are going not wanting to go to college.
Absolutely.
The second thing, and you can I want to run my second thing past you, and then you can comment. The second thing is that if you're paying $100,000 per book and it's Braille, why aren't we looking at partnering with Bookshare, and can we partner with Bookshare to get that curriculum available and have them work with us to make it available to blind people?
We are working with Bookshare. We're working with some other organizations as well. Unfortunately, the crazy cost of the book is the first person or organization that has it transcribed the first time. That's why it's so expensive. Cost goes down after that. But we are working with some other organizations. But it's not. It's 100,000 first run book, and the cost goes down after the first run. But it doesn't necessarily go down at a level that you think it would go down. One of the things that's really been challenging right now in education is the fact that Indiana for the longest time was a textbook adoption state. Good news and bad news. Well, many of the states have gotten away from textbook adoption, and they've gone to, if you will, live and virtual curriculum, which people are downloading curriculums from the internet and they're doing it on a daily basis and taking it in the classroom. That's good because it's live and it's real and it's current. The bad news is that frequently leaves the students who are blind or have low vision out in the cold because they can't access the information. You know, so that is the challenge. Even within a given high school in the state, there might be five English teachers on the floor, on a given floor. They're responsible for outcomes based on the core curriculum. How they get there is up to them. They may be using five different ways on that floor. So if you think about the number of runs that have to happen to give that information to students, it's pretty incredible. And in terms of experiences, I think, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. Education alone doesn't cut it. You do need the opportunities, and I think the STEP program that we're working with in conjunction with BOSMA, that has been very instrumental. We've taken that to another level. We are now doing STEP year-round, where we are getting our students jobs. We're putting them in different opportunities during the school year rather than just summertime, so they can get some of that experience rather than, you know, just going in and handing someone a piece of paper. Other questions?
Okay. Hi, Mr. Durst.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? It's Kenzie, for those of you who don't know me. I graduated in 2016. First thing I wanted to say is IUPUI student here. So definitely I wanted to point out, too, with the 3D mapping, printing and stuff, that they are also at the Downtown Transit Center making tactile maps of the building and the bus stations. So if you're as confused about the bus bays as I am, good luck to you. It might actually help. At this time, they are in their infancy and they are looking to improve them, but that is also something else that Jacob Ayres is involved in. My second question to you is, how have you been able, and I know this was starting to happen as I left, you were just getting the Macs and the iPads up and running. Were you able to get those issued to students yet?
Yes, we do. One of the things we're really trying to do is we're trying to become a one-on-one school, mm-hmm. where every student has the opportunity to have technology in their hands. Unfortunately, technology for individuals who are blind or have low vision is very costly. We don't always have enough money to do that. the IBCF, the Lions for the state have helped us do that. So we're getting a lot more technology, iPads, Braille touches, Braille notes, refreshable Braille displays in the hands of kids. We are doing that.
Good.
You know, one of the things that I failed to mention that Barbie just told me about, one of the things that the foundation has been instrumental in, we just put in a beacon system in the school. You familiar with the beacon systems? We just put a beacon system in the school, and we're also
blind square.
Right. We put blind square in at the school. We're also doing some QR codes. So if you do have a convention at the school, which I hope you will next time, when you walk through the campus with a downloadable program on your phone, as you walk around the campus, it will tell you, you know, the education office is on your right. And you get down a little bit further, it'll say, you know, this is the business office. You get down to the student center, it'll say you're approaching the student center, and there'll be a QR code. Today's menu is such and such. So it's pretty exciting stuff. So I think it's going to create more independence and give you opportunities to access the campus more independently than probably you were able to in the past. There's a question in the back. One second. They are.
Thank you, Nancy. Chad Beach here. When I was going there, you guys had the bowling alley and the skating rink, I believe, although that wasn't used very much when I was there, and canteen and things like that. What do you have on campus now of the recreational variety, and how has that even perhaps changed with technology getting involved with maybe the enhancement of the recreational end of things?
What year did you leave, Chad?
91.
You left right before I got there then. Well, the new pool went in 99, so we used the pool, you know, a fair amount of time. We still have the bowling alley. We just put in the part of the wrestling room, we just added a pretty neat state-of-the-art fitness room where we have treadmills and elliptical trainers and some recumbent bikes and some weight machines and so on and so forth. We put that in with a grant through Anthem and the Indiana Lions this past spring, and hope to have it open and up and running at the start of the school year for students.
Jim, it's Corey. What can we do as the alumni to help any way possible to help the students there? And I was actually at the Lions Work Day, and it was wonderful. Jim actually put me to work.
Well, you know, again, I think, you know, volunteering.
Here's the last question.
Volunteering your time. Spending time on campus, being mentors for kids. You know, we started a mentor program several years ago trying to access the alumni, and quite frankly, some of the alumni were upset when I said, we need to run background checks on you before we can have you working with kids. Guess what? We have to run background checks on you if you want to work with our kids. I mean, it's how it is. Yeah, it's how it is. You know, so I think sharing your experiences and expertise, the successes that you've had, the trials and tribulations that you faced, I think sharing those with our students, there's some advantages to that. Volunteering for our work days, being part of those. Those kinds of things help. And I know everyone is concerned about this study with the consolidation of the schools. What I would tell you at this point in time is, don't overreact to it, but don't necessarily underreact to it either. I think we need to let the system run its course before we respond to it. And I think it's important to respond to the situation rather than react to the situation. And I think let's wait and see what comes of it, and see where it goes. You know, because you know, at the end of the day, the study may end up saying the school should continue to be separate, and the study may end up saying we haven't done our due diligence in making this campus as good as it could be, and we need to add more resources to the existing campus. You know, so just wait and see where it goes. I'll keep you apprised of that situation, and we'll go from there. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity. Appreciate it.